Hello, I'm Caesar Brumino. This is number 0125, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0125. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet former NHLer Doug Smith, who's on to talk about trauma. He's been through a lot himself, and he's the author of The Trauma Code. What's the biggest danger in hockey today?
I don't believe it's the traumatic brain injury is the issue, fighting, concussions, tough guys, you know, it's speed. I mean, in the game of hockey, if we're going to talk specifically about hockey, it's about the speed. There's no real way that we can slow the game down, so there are going to continue to be serious injuries and head trauma regardless of what we do. There's adjustments that are being made. The prevention is important. Making sure that guys are accountable for their actions is important. But the speed, unless you take the speed out of the game, these types of injuries are going to continue.
Sociologist BJ Gallagher talks about the lack of social graces. Apparently, this is not a new trend.
I had a colleague who collected political cartoons from when our nation was very young. The political cartoons back then were vicious, personal, verging on libelous. They were really nasty and mean, and I thought, wow, I guess politics has always been a nasty game. But now as I look around at the social media landscape, I think, oh, I don't think it's just politics. I think it's just human nature.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. On Book Banter, Carrie Fisher spills her guts with her new confessional, Shockaholic, along with another favorite eye-opener of a Hollywood memoir. All that dirt is going to be dug up very, very soon on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0125, is Cesar Brumino, who is the owner and operator of the House of Reggae here in Montreal. And you can check out their website by going to thehouseofreggae.com. And I thank you very much, Cesar, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, here's a free pro tip for you. If you're on probation for illegal cockfighting, it's not such a great idea to go to the post office to pick up a package of live roosters. In Boynton Beach, Florida, police arrested 36-year-old Danny Pham after he did just that. Police allege that Pham's intention was to use the rooster for fighting and gambling purposes. Now, going back to February of 2009, he was one of seven men arrested during the Super Bowl that year on charges of being involved with cockfighting. At the time, he told Palm Beach County Sheriff deputies that he had invited friends over for a party to watch the football game and that he was unaware of what was going on in his backyard. A bit hard to believe, given that police found 89 roosters in cages as well as 10 transport boxes and a series of tools and equipment that are used for cockfighting. The rooster in question was confiscated and turned over to the Palm Beach County Animal Care and Control. I think a more believable excuse during the Super Bowl would have been that he was just making fresh chicken wings for the game. Not much more believable, mind you, but better than the lame excuse of complete ignorance that he came up with. Anyway, it seems not all museums are there to celebrate achievement. In Austria, an unsuccessful inventor may have finally come up with a good idea. Fritz Gall won a $600,000 government grant to set up a museum of failed inventions, flops, and disasters created by other would-be entrepreneurs. So now, the Museum of Nonsense is open for business in Hermbungarten, Austria. The museum prides itself on utterly useless creations like the portable anonymizer, a strip of black cardboard on a stick so people who don't want to be in the public eye can black out their own eyes, or there was the lead-free pencils something called a portable hole, a bristless toothbrush for people with no teeth, and a fits-anyone jumper with sleeves in various lengths. Gall thought that they'd get maybe 20 to 30 visitors on opening weekend, so he was shocked. Shocked, I say, when over 5,000 showed up. They've already decided that the museum will move to a new expanded home later this year so it can cope with the thousands, that's right, thousands of visitors who regularly flock to see it each month. God love capitalism, huh? Yeah. Anyway, there have been a lot of interesting things built out of Legos over the years, but this may be a first. Artist Zbigniew Libera created a model of a Nazi concentration camp complete with a gas chamber, watchtowers, and scientists apparently experimenting on skeletal victims, all built from the popular plastic building bricks. The model was actually built back in 1996 using bricks donated by Lego, who later denied they knew what the project was all about. The model has now been sold to the Warsaw Museum in Poland for $75,000. Zbigniew was originally criticized for what some call the trivializing of the Holocaust, but supporters say the Lego death camp shows the simple evil that led to the design of the real thing. Frankly, setting aside the disturbing subject matter, the model is quite impressive with intricate details. I've taken a look at it myself. But it does lead me to ask about the thought process of a guy who actually created it. That's something that's just a little scary. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the program. Stickney, Illinois police officer Chris Collins is in a bit of hot water after using a $132 speeding ticket he issued to track down a woman and ask her for a date, saying the least he could do for costing her so much money was to buy her dinner. Unfortunately, not only did Evangelina Paredes say no to the offer, she is now suing Collins and the police department for violating her privacy by searching motor vehicle records for her address, then leaving a handwritten note on her car windshield outside her apartment 2 days after she was ticketed. The note starts with an attempt at self-deprecating humor saying, "It's Chris, that ugly ball Stickney cop who gave you that ticket." According to the lawsuit, the letter caused the plaintiff to suffer great fear and anxiety. The plaintiff could not believe that a police officer would use his access to her personal information to find her home and stalk her. Okay, but let's be honest. If you saw the same thing played out in a romantic comedy, how many of you would have gone, "Ah"? Now, I know in real life, it's wrong. I agree with that. But if you saw it in a movie, come on, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? Just a little bit? Okay. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. At 18 years old, Doug Smith was the youngest player to have ever been drafted by the Los Angeles Kings. Over the next 11 seasons, he played with the Kings, Edmonton Oilers, Buffalo Sabres, Vancouver Canucks, and the Pittsburgh Penguins. During that time, he experienced many injuries and fought back from being a quadriplegic to walk and building organizations. Today, he's an author and an international speaker. His latest book is The Trauma Code, and Doug joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Peter.
You've had quite a career, and you've been through so much. People are talking nowadays, of course, about some of the problems that are in hockey these days, and I just want to get, first of all, your thoughts on all the chatter about what's happening with hockey injuries.
Well, my work tends to focus on the solutions. I think I look at life in this way: pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And what's happening in the game of hockey right now is all due to the optics, to the cameras, to the internet. I mean, we never saw these things before. We never were able to see into outer space with the Hubble telescope before the Hubble telescope, but then we can see things that we've never seen, and it changes our perspective. So today, what's happening is the world of optics, the cameras. There's thousands of cameras in the building, and the close-up shots are showing us things that that are making us think about what it is that we're doing. And it's not, I don't believe it's the traumatic brain injury is the issue, fighting, concussions, tough guys, you know, it's speed. I mean, in the game of hockey, if we're going to talk specifically about hockey, it's about the speed. And there's no real way that we can slow the game down. So there are going to continue to be serious injuries and head trauma, regardless of what we do. There's adjustments that are being made. The prevention is important. Making sure that guys are accountable for their actions is important. But the speed, unless you take the speed out of the game, these types of injuries are going to continue.
Okay, so as I said in the introduction, you suffered many injuries. You experienced fractures, dislocations, multiple TBI, a spinal cord injury. Hindsight is always 20/20. What would an 18-year-old Doug Smith do differently with the knowledge he has now?
Oh, I love the game. I would never dissuade anybody from playing the game, and you could put slashing and spearing and all these things in the game. As long as you tell me the rules, and I'm an adult, and I make the decision that I want to play in your league, and it's not Gary Bettman's league. This is the league is run by the owners. Gary Bettman does their bidding. It's not his ideas, it's their ideas, and it's their rules. So if they make the rules and they say to me, well, here, Doug, here are the rules, and I choose to play, that's up to me. When it comes to selling tickets, here's my perspective. You could put a lion out on the ice, and last man standing, and you have to build bigger stadiums because people would buy more tickets. So the balance is up to the owners. The balance of how they want the game to run is up to the owners. And then as it trickles down into minor hockey, that's a responsibility of the boards of directors of the associations all across Canada. And that's a huge responsibility. And those are the ones that I feel for because they're trying to figure it out. But the NHL and minor hockey, those are two different animals, two very different animals. But I, you know, you tell me the rules, it's my decision. Based on the rules today, I would jump in a second. They don't have to make any rule changes. I would play.
Okay, so let's talk about your book. The book is called A Trauma Code. Who exactly did you write the book for, and what's the biggest point you want to get across?
Well, I wrote the book for you and for your listeners, because all the physical trauma we see in professional sports is a fraction of the emotional trauma that we all suffer from in our daily life. I mean, you know, people who have just shut down. If you're waiting to retire as an individual, or you're riding the bus every day and you can't stand it, and you believe that that's normal, that's trauma. If you're feeling that you're unhappy every day and just not getting along with the way it is, and like I say, you're 55 and you're exhausted, that's trauma. We're not supposed to be exhausted and frustrated and want to run away from our jobs at that age. So I wrote the book for people who are trying to figure out how they can get through this life without having to undergo so much suffering. So what I share with my audience is I teach the audience and the reader about what awareness is, what focus is, motivation, purpose, belief in self, trust, emotional control, and asking for help. Those are the eight key points that I talk about. Because my experience with trauma and with belief started at an early age. I was put into leg braces, the same as Forrest Gump wore in Forrest Gump when I was 18 months old. So my experience with trauma goes back to when I was a young child. And the way I made it to the NHL was because my family, my mother in particular, built my belief system. She trauma-proofed me so that when I was injured, I knew how to get out of being injured. And that's what I bring to the audience, to the reader. I bring them a map that they can just pick up. It's a field guide that you can pick up if you're damaged or you're injured. And it doesn't matter whether it's a physical or an emotional injury. See, recovery and performance are the same word. The medical system loves the word recovery.
Right.
The business world loves the word performance. but they're exactly the same word, because we can't perform better unless we recover, and we won't recover unless we figure out how to perform better.
Okay, you talk about emotional trauma, and you know, you're a person who played a sport as a professional athlete, and professional athletes start what they do at a very early age in childhood. They have a professional career, and whether they have injuries or not that end their career ends at a very early age in most cases, as compared to the general population. Would that be some sort of emotional trauma? I mean, the fact that you have to give up what has been your entire life at a relatively early age when you play a professional sport?
If I can get one point across to the listeners, is where you are today, where you are in your life today is a reflection of your conditioning. It's not a reflection of your potential. We all have unlimited potential, but it's unpredictable. It's like buying a lottery ticket. The answer to your success in life lies in your conditioning. And when you feel you can't do something, or you can't get up, or you can't get going, or you can't leave that job that you hate, that's your conditioning. When you start to buy into people telling you that you can't do something, that's your conditioning. And if you find yourself saying, well, I wish I had what they had, or they're so lucky and I'm not, what you're looking at is you're looking at a reflection of your own rejected thoughts. And if I could only get one point across, is that to find happiness, to find that success that you're looking for, it's critical that you examine the conditioning in your life. When everything was taken away from me, I was designed and conditioned to knock people down, intimidate them, take what they have, and expose every conceivable weakness. That's what I was designed to do. That's why I made it to the NHL, because I did that well and I was conditioned to do it. When I was paralyzed, when I broke my neck and my professional hockey career ended, and I was lying in a bed looking at the ceiling, without the ability to move anymore, my identity had been taken away. I was left with nothing but my mind. I had to find a different way. And the way that I got out of my situation, and the way I continue to get out of painful situations, and what I teach, is that if we examine our conditioning, we will find that way. If we just continually focus on our potential, it's an illusion. It's an illusion because, again, it's unpredictable. So look at your conditioning in your life. Look at the experiences you've had. Sort through them. If you have to go back and apologize to people for the way that you treated them because you know now that you treated them badly, then do it. Don't hesitate. Go back and do that. And that will be a step in the right direction.
Very strong words indeed. The book is called The Trauma Code. It's written by Doug Smith. And I believe people can go to your website, which is DougSmithPerformance.com, correct?
Yeah, thetraumacode.com, DougSmithPerformance.com. If you search Doug Smith and trauma on the internet and you can't find me, you need a new computer or a new brain. If you have a brain out there and you want it to perform better, and performing better, what it is just improving the quality of our performance, right? If you want to improve the quality, the manner or functioning of your brain and your body, that's what this will do for you. So if you have a brain and you want to perform better, then pick it up. Pick up the book at my website. And I always open myself up for people to call me if they want to call me, and they do, and I'm excited because they do. Call me at 613-832-7782. I only have two rules when I work with people or organizations. The first rule is never compare yourself to anyone else. Because as soon as you start doing that, you start moving backwards. Never compare yourself to anyone else. And the second rule is never call and apologize for bothering me, because we're on the clock. Let's get going. Let's get working on it.
Doug, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much for the time, and have a great 2012, Peter.
Doug Smith, author of The Trauma Code. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0125, and you'll find links to Doug's website where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to sociologist B.J. Gallagher about social graces, or the lack thereof. We'll also have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. And of course, as always, there is an idiot of the day coming your way. Stick around for that. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Now, for the last 35 years in Columbus, Ohio, 87-year-old Willis Welsh has been getting a free pecan pie that would mysteriously show up at his door around Christmas time from a secret Santa. Alas, that wonderful annual surprise is apparently coming to an end. Mr. Welsh says this year the pie came, as always, but also was accompanied by a note which was signed The Pie Fairy. It read, "It's been a great ride. My wings are shorter now, and I am a little too fat to fly anymore, but I still love you." After all this time, Welsh says he still doesn't know who the pies come from, but they must know him well enough to know that pecan pie is his favorite pie. He says the first pie showed up in 1976, and his two daughters have denied any involvement. Talk about a bittersweet story, huh? Yeah. Okay, now, can't tell if this is the worst budding politician of all time, or if this kid has just already mastered the skills of your average public office holder. 19-year-old Kyle Bauer was recently elected and just sworn in as a member of the Albertus Borough Council in Albertus, Pennsylvania. Now, it's a pretty amazing accomplishment for a teenager. Now, too bad his swearing-in ceremony took place just a few hours after his guilty plea for stalking his ex-girlfriend, throwing a brick through her window, and slipping out of handcuffs during an alcohol-related arrest. At his court appearance, Councilman Bauer told Lehigh County Judge Robert Steinberg he's a changed man since he stopped drinking, and you'll be happy to know that the city's newest council member does have plans to get his GED after dropping out of high school. But in the meantime, he still faces charges including resisting arrest, escape, and public drunkenness in neighboring Berks County. You know, after hearing this story, the question just begging to be asked is, who voted for this guy? That's what I want to know. Who? And who was he running against? If this is what they elected, how bad was the other guy? Anyway, police say a 31-year-old Salt Lake City woman wore a fake mustache, you heard me right, a fake mustache, in a lame attempt to disguise herself as a man while stealing from her neighbors. Neighbors that had entrusted her with the key to their home, I may add. The woman's neighbors noticed thousands of dollars in cash missing from their home over several occasions, so they set up a trap with security cameras and planted cash as bait. The camera showed a woman wearing a very large man's suit, a beanie hat, and a fake mustache. Despite the disguise, the neighbors easily recognized the woman, plus police later found the disguise in the woman's home. You know, I almost made this woman the idiot of the day, but not quite. Almost. But the idiot of the day does come later. Stay tuned for it. Okay, it took some doing, but 67-year-old grandmother Alberta Kelly of Unionton, Pennsylvania, finally convinced authorities she had no idea that was marijuana growing next to her tomatoes in her backyard garden. A jury, yes, this went to a jury, found her not guilty of drug possession and manufacturer charges once she told them that she simply tossed a handful of seeds into her garden after a bearded stranger gave them to her. Police charged Kelly a year ago after receiving a tip about her interesting garden. Investigators say they found 7 well-cultivated 4-foot marijuana plants behind her home. So, a bearded stranger just gave her seeds and she tossed them into the garden? Well, at least it wasn't the beanstalk. Moving right along, Flint, Michigan just got what might be a world's first. Reverend Steve Bentley says he's doing everything he can to reach out to people who have never felt comfortable at a traditional house of worship. So he just opened a tattoo parlor inside his church. Bentley's church, The Bridge, occupies 3,000 square feet inside a Flint, Michigan shopping center. Serenity Tattoo is located not far from his office, as well as a galvanized watering trough that he uses for baptisms. 2 tattoo artists work at the county licensed shop that is open every day except Sunday. He scoffs at his critics who claim a church is a wrong place for a tattoo parlor, saying tattooing is a morally neutral practice akin to having your ears pierced. And the good Reverend Bentley has 2 tattoos of his own. Ah, yes, the Lord works in mysterious ways, doesn't he? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, while pilots are trained for all types of unexpected emergencies, seeing a shark flying by your cockpit window is not one of them. A pilot in New Zealand couldn't believe his eyes when he saw a 5-foot shark flying past him at 7,000 feet. He'd been preparing to land at Christchurch International Airport when he spotted the 5-foot shark staring back at him. Turns out the shark, and I'm doing air quotes now, is or was an inflatable remote-controlled toy aircraft that had flown off course. The Air Swimmer toys were a popular present this Christmas in New Zealand, and police have been bombarded with reports of escaped inflatable sharks. Why would anyone make a flying shark anyway? I don't know. Okay, so as a pilot, when you get on the radio, just what do you tell the tower that you saw in a way that doesn't get you locked up for observation when you land? That's what I want to know. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Sociologist B.J. Gallagher was a frequent guest on our old radio show. She's the author of many books, including A Peacock in the Land of Penguins, and her new book, which is coming out in February, called Being Buddha at Work. I thought it was time to invite her back on the show, this time talking a little bit about the social graces, or lack thereof, of our time. BJ is on the line with us right now from California. Happy New Year, BJ.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for being on the show with us. And the topic of social graces, I came up with this idea because, as you know, I spend a lot of time online and on Twitter and Facebook and all the others. And especially when you go to places like YouTube, the comments that people leave on videos that they watch and the battles that they have with people who leave comments before them, it seems all civility has gone out the window, not only in those situations, but also in political debates. What's happened?
I know. It can be very disconcerting and very discouraging. Sometimes when I look at the comments, I feel the same way. I think, really, really, just this gratuitous nastiness, and it's very, it escalates to being personal very quickly. Like, oh, you're so stupid, you know, you're an idiot. How could anybody think that? it gets personal really fast.
Well, where do you think this started from? Has this something that we've always had and the internet has just brought it out? Or was there a sea change at some point that allowed this to happen?
I think human beings have always been like this. And I don't have any data other than anecdotal data to support that. But, you know, I've as a sociologist, my job is to watch people. So I've been watching people for decades now. I don't want to tell you how many decades, but lots of them. And I can tell you that from what I've seen, for instance, I had a colleague at Berkeley who collected political cartoons from when our nation was very young and early elections for the presidency and governors and things like that. And the political cartoons back then were vicious, personal, verging on libelous. They were really nasty and mean and ugly and personal. And I thought, wow, I guess politics has always been a nasty game. But now as I look around at the social media landscape, I think, oh, I don't think it's just politics. I think it's just human nature. At least American human nature or North American human nature. I'm not sure about the rest of the world because I don't read all those languages, but just judging from what North Americans write, it's pretty ugly.
Okay, so if as you say, in the United States, political fighting has gone on, scathing fighting has gone on since the beginning of your nation, basically.
Yes.
Is it the fact that we now have things like C-SPAN and we now have interview possibilities and we now have Twitter and Facebook and the like that we see that stuff being played out more in our daily lives and therefore it gravitates to the general population? I mean, if our politicians can do it, why can't we?
Yes. And I think our politicians were mirroring what we were doing all along. It just didn't get printed or publicized. In other words, what the internet does and what the 24-hour news cycle does and what reality TV does is it really just holds up a mirror so we can see ourselves in a way that we didn't see ourselves before, that we're a bunch of irrational people that are just run by judgments and opinions that are half-baked and ill-informed, and it's just human nature.
Are we collectively an angrier people than we used to be? Because in addition to the verbiage that goes on online, we're hearing more about road rage and shopping cart rage and airline passenger rage and, you know, pick your favorite whatever rage.
Well, America has always been a very violent country. I don't know about Canada and your history, but we've always been a violent country. And here's a little tidbit of data that just came out today that the police department just announced the crime rate for last year, that the crime rate in Los Angeles is the lowest it has been since 1957.
Hmm.
So I'm not so sure that we're angrier and meaner and nastier and more deadly. It's that when we are, it gets broadcast in the echo chamber. You have this because the media has to fill up 24 hours of airtime. And 40 years ago or 50 years ago when I was a kid, they didn't. You know, the networks went off at a certain time, and we didn't have CNN and all this. There's a huge appetite for information, and in the lack of new information, they just keep echoing the old information, so everything gets magnified and reverberated and repeated, so it seems like things are worse. But actually, at least according to that one statistic, that the crime rate is the lowest, the murder rate, the theft rate, the burglary rate, all of them, they're all the lowest they've been since the since the Eisenhower years.
Well, as a sociologist,
that's pretty incredible.
As a sociologist, let me throw out this theory to you.
Okay.
And tell me if you think it's correct. Crime is a young man's game, usually men. Men of a certain age.
Yes.
And as people get older, those who may have committed crimes in their youth, they probably don't commit crimes when they're older. And that group of people you mentioned during the Eisenhower administration, we're talking basically the teenagers of the baby boom.
Yes.
So is it not possible that one of the reasons the crime was higher then is because there were so
many
people?
All the criminals are too old?
No, seriously, because all the there were more people of a certain age to commit those crimes.
I don't know. That's an interesting theory. I mean, but one would think that with increasing population density, you know, in the greater Los Angeles basin, we have 9 million people here. You would think with the greater population density and the greater diversity, which you'd think might put people at odds with each other or groups of people at odds with each other, that the crime rate would go up. But I'll tell you what, you know how they explain it, the police chief and the mayor, we now have 10,000 officers on the street. So they say it has nothing to do with the people getting nicer. We just have more cops.
So bottom line, are we getting worse as time goes on? Are we heading toward the end? Were the Mayans right?
No, I don't think the Mayans were right. I think somebody has misinterpreted the Mayan calendar. And, you know, they either just ran out of space or I don't know. But, no, I don't think the world is coming to an end. But I do think that every generation, at least for as long as I've been alive, thinks that things are getting worse than they were when they were young. I find that interesting. You know, when I was young, my parents thought that Elvis and blue jeans and swiveling hips and, you know, we were all going to hell in a handbasket. And then the 60s came along and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they thought the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And these days it's rap and hip-hop and, you know, we think the world's going to hell in a handbasket. I don't know. Every generation seems to think that the next generation is worse and that the whole world is going to hell in a handbasket.
So
I don't know. I think it's just perception.
So you're still optimistic, and I guess you're not reading a lot of the comments on YouTube.
I just don't read them. They're so nasty. I just go, ouch, it hurts to read that. I mean, people make comments. I write for Huffington Post, and, of course, I write about the kinds of things that most people aren't going to make nasty comments about anyway. But even, like, I've written a few columns about Buddhist topics because of my new book, of Being Buddha at Work. I did one on September 11th called Books, Bombs, Buddha, and Bush, about September 11th, and what would Buddha say about terrorists, and what would Buddha tell George Bush? And there were even a couple of really snarky comments by people who are Buddhists who are putting down other people going, you don't really know your Buddhism. You know, it's spiritual snobbery that I just go, oh my God, people, look at yourselves.
Well, we're just about out of time. We're just about out of time. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And you say, as you say, your new book is coming out called Being Buddha at Work. It's coming out in the month of February. Will you come back on the program in February and talk about your new book?
I'd love to. And I'll bring Buddha with me.
I look forward to that. I thank you very much, BJ, for being on the program with us.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
Sociologist BJ Gallagher. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0125, and you'll find links to her website. And we will have her back on the program next month to talk about her new book, Being Buddha at Work. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In the time it takes me to say that greeting each week, two lawsuits are filed somewhere in the United States. Incredibly, there's one lawsuit filed every 2 seconds in America. So here, in just the second week of the year, there have already been around 300,000 lawsuits filed in America's courts. This is way too many, and it might surprise you what happens with most of these cases. According to a new book called Rebuilding Justice, only 1% of these lawsuits will actually go to trial. That's right, 99% of lawsuits don't even go to trial. The co-author of that book is a respected judge who spent 11 years on the Colorado Supreme Court. She believes that so many lawsuits are settled out of court not because of the merits of each case, but rather because one party or the other has simply run out of money. Let's be fair, that isn't a justice system, it's a fight for survival. Find out what can be done to fix it. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Stuart Nauman once again with Book Banter. Happy New Year, sir.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Peter. It's happy 012.
012, yes. Let's hope the Mayans were wrong.
Yes. Look, they have how many years to try and prove this?
Hmm? No one's around to argue with at this point.
No, I don't see any Mayan experts, on any of those cable shows. So, and that calendar is kind of cracked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it can fall apart any time.
Much like I understand the first author of the year you have.
Yeah. What a great little segue, Peter. Yes, you're absolutely right, because there are many psychologists and psychiatrists who agree that the practice of putting your feelings in writing, which is known as journaling, can be quite therapeutic for those who have serious personal issues. Now, actress Carrie Fisher put that practice to a whole new extreme 3 years ago. Her brutally honest exercise in written self-confession became the 2008 best-selling memoir Wishful Drinking, in which her upbringing as the daughter of 1950s singer Eddie Fisher and actress Debbie Reynolds, and her sudden international fame for her role as Princess Leia Organa in the first Star Wars trilogy, along with all the personal baggage that accompanied it, including her drug-induced affair with Cary Grant, turned into a Tony-nominated one-woman show on Broadway and a critically acclaimed special on HBO that was nominated for an Emmy. And for those who couldn't get enough of the actress's bold, unabashed confessions of that dysfunctional Hollywood life, they will be satisfied to know that Fisher has put out a sequel to Wishful Drinking called Shockaholic.
Now, that book, technically speaking, I mean, here we are in 2012, but that book came out in 2011, correct?
Shockaholic, yeah, that's right.
Okay, so here's the question for you.
Yeah.
How many books came out in 2011 that included a drug-induced sexual escapade with Cary Grant?
Not that many.
More than one.
Well, Diane Cannon put out her memoirs, and so did daughter Jennifer Grant. those are two books, but you probably didn't read about any drug-induced sexual relations.
Well, I think in the Diane Cannon one that was mentioned...
Possibly, but certainly not Jennifer Grant.
No, certainly not. Hope not. No, no, no.
Well, if there was, it would garner a lot of more publicity than the book would have gotten.
Yeah.
But getting back to Shockaholic, Fisher describes some of the more difficult aspects of her Hollywood life and her painful road to recovery. And this includes the period of time she underwent a series of electroconvulsive shock therapy treatments called ECTs that she admits were not as draconian as they were portrayed in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But as a consequence, it erased part of her memory. She also writes quite eloquently and passionately about her friendship with the late Michael Jackson and empathizes with his struggle with celebrity and fame that led to his untimely death back in 2009. And there's also some bizarre yet funny segments in this book. One that I found really bizarre was a quote-unquote tribute to her stepfather, a shoe store magnate named Harry Carl, whom Reynolds married shortly after her marriage to Eddie Fisher crumbled thanks to Elizabeth Taylor. Now, basically, Fisher saw Carl as a man who defined square, but with plenty of peculiar habits, including a propensity to sleep without pajama bottoms or underwear, and incessantly passing gas while sleeping. Basically, the reaction you get after reading this chapter is to tell Debbie Reynolds, look, I know you're broken up with the way Eddie Fisher left you for Elizabeth Taylor, but why'd you have to marry that? The book ends on a rather bittersweet note. It deals with Fisher's long, painful efforts to reconcile with her estranged father, Eddie Fisher, whom in his final years was a philandering drug addict and was rapidly deteriorating due to dementia. Now, although a sense of bitterness and anger pervaded Fisher for a very long time, and understandably so, her efforts to reestablish the father-daughter bond and take care of him as his health faded up until his death in 2010 are quite admirable. It's a lesson we can all take with us when it comes to fixing estranged relationships with our aging parents. Now, Shockaholic may not have all the eye-opening Hollywood revelations that made Wishful Drinking such a roller coaster ride of a book. However, it's an interesting read that further helps Carrie Fisher on her road to recovery.
Now, what I'd like to know
is
how she knows that Harry slept bottomless and also passed gas when he sleep.
That's
just too creepy.
Well, Mom Debbie probably filled her in on that sometime, you know, during a couple of mother-daughter conversations. That's the only way I could, you know, guess that she got that info.
I would hope.
I sure hope there wasn't any first-hand information, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, and you know what? Just speaking of eye-opening Hollywood memoirs, there's one that I really have to recommend that was I found kind of sobering and kind of a shocker myself was, I don't know if you read Gary Crosby's Going My Own Way?
Oh, yes.
About his life with Derbingle.
Yeah.
And how he withstood all that physical abuse and the verbal abuse, especially the bucket butt labels that he used to impose upon him. Interesting book, but very sobering. And that's pretty well eye-opening also. I mean, Gary had an act with his other brothers, actually. And it broke up after he had a huge backstage brawl during an appearance in Montreal back in the late 50s.
Hmm. So are you tossing Carrie's book in with his book, Mackenzie Phillips' book, Mommy Dearest?
Yeah, I think we won't read Debbie Dearest, but I think to a degree actually.
Okay,
I won't be surprised if this makes the stage, you know, in the not too distant future.
Well, her stage shows are excellent. I saw the last one she did for HBO, which was great.
Yeah, which was based on Wishful Drinkings, and she's got. She has that appeal to sustain a one-woman show, so I wouldn't be surprised if Shockaholic makes it to the Broadway stage, you know, sooner than you think.
So the book is called?
It's called Shockaholic by Carrie Fisher. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's just $26.
And how can people find you, Mr. Nullman?
Well, if you can't read me in print, you could see me online every week at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we still have a few Stuff File news stories to get to before we wrap things up with the idiot of the day. For 35 years, the family of Theodore Ted Zale thought he was one of the unfortunate victims of serial killer John Wayne Gacy. Turns out that was a wrong conclusion, as Zale was found alive and well and living in Oregon. He had apparently disappeared by choice all those years ago while going through a divorce. Cook County Sheriff Thomas Dart said being able to tell an 88-year-old father that his son, whose picture he had been carrying around for 34 years in his breast pocket, had been found alive is something special. The sheriff's office confirmed that Zale, who is now 59, is living in Beaverton, Oregon, and left town when he was 24 years old. Zale's description fit the general profile of several of Gacy's victims, and his car had been found abandoned near Chicago's O'Hare Airport, which is near where the serial killer lived. That led his family to believe that he was likely one of the victims, and he had been killed. Gacy was put to death in 1994 for the killings of 33 boys and young men between 1972 and 1978. Zale is thought to have been victim number 19. But of course now we know he was not. Oopsie. I guess somebody owes John Wayne Gacy an apology. Anyway, son Theodore Zimmick and two other relatives filed a lawsuit in November against the St. Stanislaus Cemetery in Pittsburgh for the unprofessional burial of Theodore's mother, Agnes, in 2009. Agnes had purchased an 11-by-8-foot plot in 1945, but when she finally passed away, the graveyard had become so crowded that, according to the lawsuit, workers were forced to dig such a small hole that they had to jump up and down on the casket and whack it with poles to fit it into its space. Yeah, well, that's urban sprawl for you, huh? Moving right along, a December New England Journal of Medicine report described a woman's losing her breast implant during a Pilates movement called the Valsalva, which apparently involves breath holding while bearing down. The woman said she felt no pain or shortness of breath, but suddenly noticed that her implant was gone. Doctors at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore discovered that because of the woman's recent heart surgery, the muscles between the ribs had loosened and the implant had merely passed through the rib opening. Well, now there's a question you don't want to hear at a gym. Excuse me, has anyone seen my breast implant? Yes. Managers of Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York, decided recently to relocate the statue of Abraham Lincoln that, since 1895, had occupied a seldom-visited site and whose advocates over the years had insisted be given more prominence. It turned out that the most viable option was to swap locations with the conspicuous 1906 statue of Dr. Alexander Skeen. Lincoln is certainly universally revered, but Dr. Skeen has advocates too, and some, according to a December Wall Street Journal report, are resisting the relocation because Dr. Skeen, unlike Lincoln, was a Brooklynite, and Dr. Skeen, unlike Lincoln, had a body part named after him, Skeen's glands, which is thought to be vital in understanding the G-spot. You know, if you ask me, I think it would only be fitting that they moved his statue to a place where most people can't find it. Would also be ironic, wouldn't you think? A balaclava-wearing man kidnapped Julian Buchwald and his girlfriend in 2008 in Australia's Alpine National Park as they were picnicking. The man separated the couple, tore off their clothes, and buried them. But Buchwald escaped and rescued the girlfriend, and they wandered around naked for days before being rescued. The balaclava-clad man, it turns out, was Buchwald, whose plan was to convince the woman by his heroism that she should marry him, and more immediately, to have sex, even though they had both pledged to remain virgins until marriage. Buchwald was convicted in Victoria County Court and sentenced in December to more than 7 years. Now that's one twisted Rube Goldberg-esque type of scheme, if I've ever heard one. And you know, I was seriously giving some thought to making him the idiot of the day, but I did not. But this next person is indeed the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
Tychia Lorraine Rembert, age 33, of York City, Pennsylvania, ordered her food at a Burger King drive-thru just like any other customer. But after that, according to police, things got unusual. Hiding a crowbar under her jacket to make it look like a gun, she allegedly demanded money from the person in the drive-thru window and then fled. Police were able to track her down, though, after she called the restaurant to find out if anyone had seen her license plate. Police traced the location of the call and arrested Rembert. She is charged with robbery, theft, receiving stolen property, simple assault, reckless endangerment, and making terrorist threats. Now, why would someone commit a crime and then later call the scene of the crime to find out if anyone had seen her license plate? One reason, and one reason only, she's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0125. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's number 0125. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.